putting round pegs in square holes. The inviting of a veteran of the horse cavalry to speak to a Navy wives luncheon should fit this. But I want you to know what you've done for my morale. Before lunch, you were all so kind, and as I stood in there doing a little penmanship practice, I couldn't help but remember recently on the occasion or a few months ago of the Santa Claus parade in Hollywood. Sitting in a car, Nancy and I waiting, and our names on the side of the car for the parade to start, and two young ladies came down the line reading the names. Rib, the one on the side of our car, stepped up and asked for an autograph, which I was very happy to sign. And while I was signing it, though, she nudged her friend and said, if my mother were here, she'd flip. But, of course, we have something in common at that. I once commanded a submarine in a picture. As a matter of fact, almost single-handed, we won World War II. Which was something of an accomplishment when you stop to think that we never even untied the thing from a dock in San Diego. Nancy was in the picture playing a Navy nurse and my girlfriend, and it added quite a spice to the living, inasmuch as we had two children at the time, it seemed. But now, I would like to talk to you on some rather serious subjects, and I know they must be of concern to you. I know something of the debt that a great many people in this country perhaps are unaware of, the debt that they owe to people like yourselves, because you certainly know the price of freedom. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence said, it is not our duty to leave wealth to our children, but it is our duty to leave liberty to them. We have counted the cost of this contest, and we find nothing so dreadful as voluntary slavery. And how appropriate those words are today. The declaration they signed then was unequivocal in its assertion that every man had unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the freedom of choice conferred upon him at birth by the Creator. And then they augmented this declaration, not too much later, by drawing up the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights. And 70 years would go by before England's Lord Acton, the same Lord Acton who coined the phrase that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, would say of their work and what they had done, that they had solved with astonishing and unexampled success two problems which had heretofore baffled the capacity of the most enlightened nations. They had contrived a system of federal government which prodigiously increased the national power and yet respected local liberties and authorities, and they had founded it on the principle of equality without surrendering the securities for property and freedom. And now we're engaged in a contest to see if the nation and the way of life they created can long endure. And there's a great deal of confusion about this contest. We're hesitant to recognize it for what it really is. But in reality, we're in a war not only between nations, but a war of fundamental philosophies. Communism versus capitalism. Now, there are some people that flinch at the use of either one of those words. Some people get a little self-conscious anymore in talking about capitalism. And certainly there are some people that would find another name for communism, as if by calling it something else, it might become something else. Well, it won't. Pravda, and the word means truth in Russian, says of communism, it is all-embracing, all-blood-soaked reality, and its goal is to destroy capitalism. They go on to say there can never be a someday mixture of the two. Well, here I think we should be in complete agreement. Because you can't be a little bit socialist, or you can't be partly free. Freedom is indivisible, and it isn't spelled with an S. Dr. Howard Kirshner, a noted economist, tells of a visit not too long ago to the Kremlin, and he was visiting with a high-ranking Soviet official. And in the midst of their conversation, This Soviet official smiled genially across the desk, and he said, Dr. Kirshner, we'll be over to finish the takeover sooner than you think. You know that a mixed economy is not permanent, and you have already mixed so much socialism with your formerly free economy that you can't take it back or change. You're coming all the way into full socialism, and we don't have to fight you or urge you. We shall just simply wait until you walk voluntarily into our camp. Now, by contrast, the late Herbert Hoover spent his sunset years seeking an explanation, studying, as to how, what could account for the great industrial progress, the great wealth of this nation. He found that other lands were equally blessed with natural resources, their people energetic, talented, with ability to work and conceive of new programs. And he found also that they had similar climate and area in many instances. But he then found the difference. We had here, to a greater extent than any other people, individual freedom. We had unleashed the individual genius of each man. We'd given him freedom of choice and the right to try, and yes, to try and fail and to try again. His own initiative, the only height or limit to the heights he could fly. There's no other explanation for the fact that 6% of the world's population, occupying only 7% of the world's land surface, has been able to create and own 50% of the world's wealth. And let it be recorded here that in this great day of so much materialism and yet at the same time such a social consciousness about our obligation to our fellow humans, that in this land, at the same time, we have distributed that wealth more widely among our people than any society that has ever been heretofore known to man. Poverty here, for the most part, is measured by a lack of luxuries or a scarcity of luxuries. While in the rest of the world, poverty means actually the lack of enough food and shelter and clothing. But somewhere a perversion has taken place. Our rights now are considered to be a dispensation of government. Freedom has been made divisible by a majority vote. The Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, hands down a ruling so contrary to the Constitution that it's hard to believe that the governors and the legislatures of 50 states didn't rise up in outraged shock. At this destruction of our basic federal tradition, I speak of reapportionment and the court's outright denial of state sovereignty. Here in this decision, it was made plain that we were going to change from a republic to literally the mobocracy of majority rule. Now, this idea that 50% of the people plus one can do anything they please to the rest simply because they outnumber them is again contrary to the philosophy underlying our entire traditional structure. Majority rule is a mechanism. It's a means of administering affairs, but only if the rights of the individual are guaranteed by a set of ground rules. One's right to life and liberty and freedom, freedom to worship, to speak, to assemble, in short, our inalienable God-given rights, cannot be submitted to a vote. The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to forever put those rights beyond the reach of majority rule. And this is the unique nature of our heritage, the heritage we'll pass on to our children. And perhaps it's time to check on that inheritance and see if our children are going to know the freedom that we have known, the freedom that was intended for us by the founding fathers. The trouble is, when we talk of freedom, I think we've gone far afield. It's become kind of 4th of July oratory. We deal too often in abstract and nebulous terms. We don't talk enough in specifics. Perhaps this is the reason why a recent survey was taken of 5,000 young people between the ages of junior in high school and junior in college. Now, 5,000 is a survey in depth. You can understand perhaps that when I tell you that the Nielsen rating that can determine the life and death of a television show is based on only 1,800 people throughout the entire nation. This 5,000 survey of young people found that almost two-thirds said the government should provide jobs and that workers should not produce all they can and rejected the profit motive as necessary in our society. And a half of them said that the government should own the banks and steel production and transportation and other forms of heavy industry. And 84% of them denied that patriotism played any part in their lives. Well, in too many instances, perhaps that's because they've been reading textbooks lately that devote an entire chapter to public welfare and not one line to Patrick Henry. So they ask, who's free? These young people, they say, I've got my parents at home, and when I get to school, there are teachers, and if I do manage to get the old man's car and get out on the road for a ways, there's a fellow on a motorcycle. Well, let's tell them, and begin now telling them what we mean in practical terms by freedom. I remember a still fairly young man, a book publisher in this country, a German, immigrant to America, who told me what freedom meant to him and how he'd learned about it. He had gone to school in Germany, not under Hitler, but under the Weimar Republic, when we thought that Germany had a system similar to ours, a constitution, a parliament, a president. And yet going to school there in that supposedly free republic, he told me one day of how these boys sat in a class and heard a professor trying to illustrate freedom to them. And he said, can you imagine what it meant to us when he said, as his example of freedom, he said, suppose you were standing on the shores of the United States. He said, ahead of you is 3,000 miles of country. And he said, you can go any place in that 3,000 miles you want without asking anyone's permission. You can stay where you want to, stop as long as you'd like, move on when you please, and you don't have to ask anyone. And he said he was telling that to boys who knew that in our own community, we couldn't even move from one apartment to the next without going to the city hall and getting a police pass or permit to do this. So we have to start telling our young people that freedom means selecting the school of their choice. Freedom means or not going to college if they choose not to. Living where they want to live. Taking a trip without asking someone's permission. Without getting permission to leave town and stating why they're going and where they're going and then checking in at the city hall at the next town. In Hungary, they talk today of the increasing leniency of living under the Soviet in Hungary. But young people who get married there are still required by law to live either with his parents or hers. And then after several years of their names being on a waiting list, perhaps the government will assign them dwelling space. In Russia, they've just announced a new housing goal for urban housing. And they're going to strive for 64 square feet of living space, 8 by 8, for each citizen in Russia. By curious coincidence, in the United States, 8 by 10, 80 square feet, is the minimum size for a prison cell. So I think we have to talk to them of a constitution not revered because of dusty tradition or outmoded, but tolerated because of age. But make them understand that it's a living document, a contract guaranteeing the most limited and equitable government ever known in the long history of man's relation to man. And in that connection, maybe we could use a comparison. There's a clause in the Soviet Constitution that guarantees the Soviet people the right of assembly, the right to express themselves. Not very many of them take advantage of that right. But anyway, it's there in the Constitution. And we have such a clause, freedom of speech and assembly. And some people have said, well, what is the great difference between our two peoples? Well, the difference is so great that it describes the entire situation, and yet it's so subtle it almost escapes us. Simply this, the Soviet Constitution says, we, the government, grant you this right. And our Constitution says you're born with this right and no government on earth can take it from you. The most valuable part of the inheritance is this idea, never before tried in the world, that you and I have certain unalienable rights, that government is beholden to us and it has no other source of power and can do only those things which we, the sovereign people, permit it to do. But now there's a new philosophy abroad in the world and abroad in this land. Men in high place in government talk of the need for planning, and they question the ability now of people to control their own destiny in this complex world. These men chafe under the constitutional restraints and are impatient with the slow process of provided for altering the Constitution by amendment. And so they embark on this dangerous folly of changing that document by judicial interpretation. Fine the prodigious increase in national power, but not so fine the respect for local authority. They ignore the word unreasonable in the interpretation of the article protecting a citizen against unreasonable search and seizure. And suddenly crime skyrockets and our city streets become jungle paths as the hands of local law enforcement officers are tied by these judicial rulings. It's almost inconceivable today that this could happen in our country. But do you know that not too long ago, a policeman saw two men coming out of a Western Union office at a time when the office was closed and they were carrying something. And he thought it was his duty to go over and investigate. And as they saw him coming, they hastened their steps and they threw what they were carrying into the back seat of a car, jumped in the car, and took off. He rushed over, saw that the door had been left ajar, hailed a passing car, commandeered it, and finally overtook the two men, pulled them over to the side of the road, and there in the back seat was the safe with the printing on it, Western Union. Case dismissed. This constituted unreasonable search and seizure. He didn't have any right to stop those men on suspicion. We take out of context the word welfare and pretend there's a clause in the Constitution giving central authority the unlimited power to legislate what it believes is for the welfare of the people. And actually, there is no such thing as a welfare clause and never has been. So we embark on a plan to eliminate slums, and certainly no responsible citizen would suggest that Americans should live in degradation. But we suddenly discover that we've canceled out our traditional laws of eminent domain, our protection against the seizure of private property. Now, we know that, of course, down through the years, occasionally government has found it necessary, upon the proof that there is a clear and present need in the public interest, to take someone's private property upon the payment of a fair price. But now, government can force the sale of our homes and resell them to other individuals under the Urban Renewal Program and make a profit, and the entire transaction is subsidized by tax funds. And by a strange quirk of making the end justify the means, the same people who deny the policeman the right to legitimate search and seizure in our protection at the same time rule it's all right under the agricultural program to seize a man's farm and sell it at auction to enforce the payment of a fine if he has violated the planting allotments as dictated by the Department of Agriculture. And the Supreme Court rules, yes, the government has a right to tell a citizen what he can put on his own land or plant on his own land for his own use. Free speech now is interpreted as meaning that some young Americans have the right to burn their draft cards and interfere with the shipment of munitions and supplies and replacements for other young Americans who are dying in a war that isn't a war, and while they're denied the right to try for victory. There's no more noble purpose than salvaging young people who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet their responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. I think it is the noblest work of man to give each young person a fair start in life and an equal opportunity at the starting line. But now under federal welfare, in a poverty program recently passed, we're taking young ladies from families of destitution, we're removing them, and we're putting them for a year's training in which we're going to make them self-reliant. And while we're doing this, we provide maid service so they won't have to make their own beds. And the cost of training these young ladies prorates out to $7,000 a year for each young lady we're going to salvage. Well, you know very well how many families in this country are raising fine, productive citizens on less than $7,000 a year without asking anyone's help. Young men in this similar program are put into training camps, and they're going to be retrained and salvaged. And while they're being retrained, we do the ridiculous thing of paying them a higher salary than we give to many young men who put on a uniform and go out in the defense of their country. I should have the figures for the Navy, I don't. But I have them for the Air Force, and I can tell you that there are 55,000 airmen today in uniform who are moonlighting, working on their spare time on the outside to try and make enough to make ends meet. And there are other thousands of them that refuse to do it because of pride. Chattanooga, to show what happens when government strays too far from the people. Chattanooga just released its budget for its educational program of its 25,000 young people. It's a budget of $10 million. And then the federal government released its budget for retraining in that same area 3,300 dropouts or possible dropouts, and the budget is almost half as big as the $10 million. It's $5 million for just those 3,300. And part of it because while legitimate students in that area are limited to 15 hours outside work if they have outside jobs to earn money, the dropouts are going to be paid from tax funds for 32 hours a week so that they've created an incentive for the legitimate student to quit school and become a retrainee so that he can get a raise in pay. Meanwhile, a senator says that happily, spiritually and economically, young people are being conditioned to respond to a liberal program of orderly policing of our own society by government. Such an erudite way of saying they'll do as they're told. We're perverting the Constitution so as to make equitable taxation for legitimate purposes a license, to use the tax system to redistribute earnings and control the economy. And we've used the people's money in order to coerce the people and to bring about a government beyond the control of the people. We recognize that government, of course, has certain legitimate functions. I'm sure that every one of us are proud of those who set our course for the stars. And certainly we're proud of those who guard our shores, patrol our streets, and teach our children. We recognize that government has a very legitimate place in our daily lives, as a referee and as a regulator, to see that no individual or group in our midst can grow and take advantage of power that he might have in order to impose on the freedom of someone else. But now, government has assumed such a size that taxation has become the family's biggest burden, greater than even food and shelter. Since the beginning of the century, in our free economy, we have increased the gross national product to where today it is 33 times as big as it was then. But we have increased the cost of our federal government 234 times, and we still haven't paid our way. We're letting our children in on that. We haven't balanced the budget 29 out of the last 35 years, and the interest on our debt is $22,000 a minute. For every minute of every hour, 24 hours a day, day in and day out. The government owns a third of the real estate. A few years ago, it was only a fourth. And federal employees outnumber state employees, civilian employees, I might add, outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. And in California, that's not easy. 200 years ago, we lighted a torch that said to the downtrodden of all the world that here, men had recognized man's age-old yearning to be recognized as an individual. That here men had placed such a premium on the individual that we had pledged our collective strength of all of us for the protection of even the least individual among us. Now, this belief cannot be reconciled with even such a high-sounding phrase as the greatest good for the greatest number. Since World War II, 135 American military men, mainly airmen, have been shot down, most of them unarmed and most of them for simply getting off course and straying too close to the borders of a nation that's supposed to be a friendly power at peace with us. And we wrote notes of protest. And sometime back, Americans were held captive by savage rebels in the Congo and tortured and many of them murdered, while we debated the political consequence of going to their rescue. I'd like to tell you a contrasting story. Back more than 140 years ago, around 120 years ago, around 1840, there was a small naval vessel, American naval vessel, in a Mediterranean port. In the days preceding its presence there, there had been a revolution in Hungary, and the Hungarians had tried to free themselves from the rule of the Austrian Emperor Franz Joseph. It was an abortive revolution, like the last Hungarian effort for freedom, and the freedom fighters had fled. One of them, a young lieutenant, had fled to America. His name was Kostya. And Kostya became an importer and took out his first papers, announcing his intention to become a citizen of our country. He was in this same Mediterranean port on business. And there was a great Austrian warship in the harbor at the same time. And spies took word to the Austrian warship that Kostya, the man wanted in Austria-Hungary, was there. He was kidnapped and taken aboard this vessel, and his manservant, frantic, down at the harbor, recognized a flag that had been described to him by his master as his new flag. And he went aboard the American sloop, and he told Captain Ingram of the United States Navy what had happened to his master. And the captain went to the consul in this town and told him. And I guess when you wore striped pants, even in those days, it was the same as today. Because when the consul found out that Kostya had only taken out his first papers, he thought that absolved us from any responsibility. But Captain Ingram said, "I don't believe so. I'm the ranking officer in this port, and I believe we do have a responsibility." So he went aboard the Austrian warship, and he told the admiral commanding that ship that he demanded to see our citizen. And when he was brought on deck in chains, Captain Ingram said I can understand him better without those chains. And when the chains were taken off, he said, I'm going to ask you one question. Consider your answer carefully. Do you ask the protection of the American flag? And Kostya, who had been badly beaten and mistreated, nodded yes. And he said, you shall have it. And he went back and he told the frightened consul what he had done. And then as he returned to his own ship, two other Austrian ships sailed into the harbor. There were now three. And it began to look as if they were preparing to set sail. And he sent a lieutenant over with a message to the admiral. And it said, any attempt to leave this harbor with our citizen on board your ship will be resisted with appropriate force. And I will expect a satisfactory answer by 4 this afternoon. At a few minutes to 4, the little sloop stood facing the three giant warships. And he ordered the cannons rolled out through the ports. And then, as the clock was almost at 4, he ordered them to light those tapers with which they fired their light at the cannons, the fuses. And just then, from the lookout, came the hail they're lowering a small boat. And they brought Kostya over to the American sloop and turned him over to us. And then Captain Ingram wrote his resignation to the United States Navy. He said that what he had done, he did because he believed it was part of his oath of office when he became an officer. But he said, if I have embarrassed my country, I hereby resign. His resignation was turned down on the floor of the United States Senate with these words, this battle that was never fought may well turn out to be the most important battle in our nation's history. And to this day, there is a USS Ingram in the United States Navy, and I hope there always will be. Now, I tell this not to be chauvinistic or to express a bullying hostility, but because I believe this is the highest function of government. This indeed is government's only excuse for even existing, to see that no individual, no group in our midst, or no outside force can impose on the rights and the freedom of the individual. Well, what then must be our purpose? Well, to those who say that there is no simple answer to today's complex problems, that this would not fit in this modern day world, I say there is a simple answer. It isn't an easy answer, but it's simple. If you and I will tell those who represent us in government that we want no double standard of morality, we want no slightly immoral policy of expediency in our behalf, while at a private level, as individuals, we're supposed to insist on a stricter code in our personal lives. We want legislation to reinterpret the Constitution in those instances where judicial rulings have distorted the meaning. We want it made plain that this is a nation under God, and in God is our trust. And to those who would cancel out this contract or relegate it to some musty display case of relics, let us ask as Daniel Webster did, when people criticized it then, but who shall reconstruct the fabric of demolished government? Who shall rear again the well-proportioned columns of constitutional liberty? Who shall frame together the skillful architecture which unites national sovereignty with states' rights, individual security, and public prosperity? And then he said, hold on, my friends, to the Constitution of the United States and to the republic for which it stands. Miracles do not cluster. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. Hold on to your Constitution, for if the American Constitution shall fall, there will be anarchy throughout the world. If the people of this country today, I realize, of course, that I'm speaking to the wrong group, because I realize there is no intention on your part to fail in the challenge that faces us today. But if the rest of the people in this country let you down, and let our children down and fail in this challenge, then their failure someday will be recorded in a book not yet written called The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. Thank you.
I think that tells Mr. Regan more than anything else how much we did appreciate it. We did promise you a question and answer period. I don't know how long you would like to have it. I don't know how your time is allotted, but we did promise them things.
Oh, you caught me by surprise. I'd have shortened down and not given you the whole load if I'd have known that. Well, listen, I know it's very late and you've taken a great deal of time. If there are one or two questions that you consider that you'd like to have answered, I'll try to answer them. You may not learn anything from my answers, but I'll learn something from your questions. But I realize we, yes, ma'am. Yes, I do. The question was that the charges made that people who criticize, as I have, things that are going on in policies today are usually very vague about what we can do. Of course, I consider it a specific about the legislation to clarify and reinterpret the Constitution, both at the state and the federal level. For example, I think in reapportionment that I was heartily in favor of the Dirksen Amendment to pass an amendment to the Constitution explaining that states were granted, in our interpretation of the document, the right to have one house of a legislature apportioned on some other basis than one man, one vote. It is true, however, when you're out of power, you're a little hard put to deal in specifics because you're more or less helpless. Now, for example, in our own state government here in California, a lot of our crime, you cannot ignore the fact that crime starts its sensational rise in California directly from some of the judicial rulings that inhibited the policeman and have prevented him from doing all that he should do. And here in our state, preemption by the state government that has now denied the policeman or the local community certain efforts or areas in which he can legislate. Now, it is true that our side did introduce legislation to correct that, and it was pocket vetoed in Sacramento. It's hard to talk about your attempts unless you've got a fighting chance to put them into effect. Yes, I nurse a lot of specific ideas of some things that I think could improve the situation. But I think at the moment, my own philosophy has been that in speaking, I feel that it's necessary to sort of arouse the people or frighten them with the extent to which we have strayed from our original social or traditional structure. And so I kind of do a Paul Revere job. I figured that Paul Revere, he just yelled the British were coming when he went by. He didn't bother to stop and explain the revolution to them. Is there one more question, though? Because I know it's quite...
Well, not truly a question, but if and when you are in a position to do so, you might remember that military wives, as a whole, there are many of us who are never able to vote if and when we ever wanted to. States penalize our husbands by taxing their salaries if we choose to vote in that state. Other states make us appear in person to register for the vote before the national one. So there are many thousands of us in an army that could never vote anywhere because we move around.
Ma'am, the question here was more of a statement, but it was you're right, it was a case of hitting the nail on the head. The discrimination against you as service wives and your right to vote by restrictions and hampering rules that have been put into effect. Yes, and let me tell you again, now this is a nonpartisan meeting, understand, but I cannot ignore, and our own state has been very greatly responsible for this. It is an almost, if you will trace the legislation, not only in this area of military, but on the restrictions that have been put down, not only with this way of voting, but restrictions on the ability to enforce legitimate voting, the way that certain areas have been opened up to where it is almost impossible to challenge the false vote, the paid for, the empty lot voting, the warehouses and oil stations that are voting instead of people now. It is frightening and leads you to believe that under the guise of one man, one vote, again, there is an effort being made to emphasize the ability of some people to vote, even if they can only mark an X, and to deny some other people the right to vote. Yes, I would think that this would be an absolute must, and I would consider that anyone who was elected to office in this state would consider that his first responsibility would be to do something about the voting rules in our own state here. Well, oh, there's, well, one hand, and then I will, and then this will be up. Oh, well, this, you've gone on one that's pretty tricky there. Thank heaven it doesn't enter into state politics, but it's the State Department document with regard to disarmament. I cannot briefly go into, nor would I attempt to go into detail, some of the provisions and the clauses. And certainly, anyone would have to defend that, of course, I think the dream of all the world would be a day when we could beat the swords into plowshares. But I think that this document is, again, something very frightening to all people, with the evidence throughout this State Department document of the willingness of some people in our country to embark down the dangerous road of unilateral disarming with the hope that potential enemies in the world will follow our good example. And I think this is like going into a bear cage with a tennis racket. I, for one, as a matter of fact, I'm sorry, I think the Geneva disarmament meetings are pretty futile at a moment until we settle some of the issues that divide the world today. While men are fighting and dying in uniform for their country, I don't think this is a time that you sit down with some of the people responsible for killing them and argue about whether you couldn't do away with your weapons. I think we better settle the issues that divide us first and then see if the millennium has not been reached. But it is a dangerous program. Well, the question here was, and then I will sit down honestly, was the thing about the voting age of 18, and if young men of 18 can fight for their country, why can't they vote for it? There is only one drawback. I think this is a subject with a lot of ramifications, because I would hate to think at the same time that those kids up at Berkeley that are laying down on the railroad tracks could vote too.
Thank you again so much, Mr. Regan and Mrs. Regan, and we hope you will all come back and see us again sometime.
Again, we want to mention that our next luncheon will be November the 4th. If you will all please keep this in mind. We want to hope that you will come back and serve the new board as well as you have served the old one. We do have one more announcement to be made. Lucy Nelson has a bowling announcement. If you will just wait just 1 minute.
I'd like to ask all of you wonderful ladies to please come and join us at Rossmore Inn Bowling. We are very much in need of substitutes. At this time, we have none at all, and it is hampering our bowling. Would you please give your name or call me or Marion Kuykendall? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it was ours. Well, we usually Yes, indeed.
You can look for Mary and I can put her to work.
I have you.